Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Jen Frederick about domestic violence myths and misconceptions, talking about framing and language in the abortion debate, and tackling this ridiculous new sexist stereotype about fembots. But first, Larry Craig just doesn't know when to give up. Matt Lauer had an interview with him where Craig was a train wreck and simply didn't do anything to help his case.
Were you aware at all, Senator, of the reputation of that specific bathroom?
Well, I certainly am now.
Were you prior?
No, not at all. I walked into a bathroom, I walked into an entrapment and a sting that was going on, and I go to bathrooms to use bathrooms.
Credit to Matt Lauer for not cracking up during the ridiculous interview, even during the part where he had to sort of act out the toe-tapping, foot-nudging, hand-waving maneuver that Senator Craig did, and now claims he did just for the hell of it, and certainly not to get any sex. The good news is that the protesters at the New Aurora, Illinois Planned Parenthood are inspiring some good, angry pushback from the pro-choice community, with doctors and other health workers from Planned Parenthood coming out to talk about what they do for a living and what their lives are really like. Turns out they're good people, but you already knew that. One blog that's cropped up is I Am Emily X, a blog where Planned Parenthood workers can talk back to the protesters who are making it hard for them to dispense basic medical care to women who need it.
One day I was, yelled at, and called a slut for working here, and I was offended, but at the same time, it renews my, I have to work here, I have to, show people I'm not afraid and just come in, and do my job.
To the press, it's all babies, 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 but in person, I guess anti-choicers are more blunt about how they feel about women who have sex. This woman describes the effect of the protesters on her patients.
Patients, they come in and they're frustrated. They're like, why are they out there? What are they doing? Well, we're really not sure it's this 40 days thing, I just have a UTI, that's all. I just want to pick up birth control or whatever, Not everyone that walks in this building is here for an abortion.
She's telling the truth. Contrary to the way anti-choicers portray Planned Parenthood, it's not an abortion mill. Abortion is only 3% of its services. The rest is basic gyno care, contraception services, STD services, and the like. But I have a feeling that the anti-choicers, with their choice use of words like slut, might not care if they block women from getting birth control or treatment for STDs. I'd like to welcome Jen Frederick to the show. Jen is the Crisis Services Coordinator for the American Domestic Violence Crisis Line, which offers help and support for American women living overseas who find themselves in abusive relationships. You deal with a pretty specific clientele at the Crisis Line, which is victims who are living abroad. What are the extra challenges that you have working with this population?
Well, there's many different challenges, depending on what part of the world that they're living in. For many, they may not speak the language or they may not have resources available or may not know how to access those resources. There may be problems with getting back to the U.S., whether it's financial difficulty. Some parts of the world, there may be laws that prevent them from traveling without male escorts or without the permission of their husband. And then there's also international treaties that can prevent one parent from taking children to another country without being charged with international child abduction, and the main one being the Hague Convention on the International Child Abduction, and there is no defense right now for domestic violence. So many of our clients will manage to get back to the U.S. only to be charged with international child abduction.
So let's talk about myths and misconceptions. There's a lot of myths about cultural differences and domestic violence. Can you elaborate on what kind of false beliefs about culture that you hear in your line of work?
Well, I believe that I think there's definitely some cultural beliefs that can lead to domestic violence. And there's also some beliefs about culture that some people may assume that there's more domestic violence happening in some cultures than others. Certainly, I think most people are surprised to learn that when we're, the women we work with primarily actually are trying to come from Europe and the Americas, whereas most people would assume most of our clients are coming from the Middle East, and that's just not really where we're finding our clients coming from as much. But then there's also some cultural barriers that can happen. There are definitely some cultures where domestic violence is perceived to be as less of a problem to law enforcement and to policymakers. In general, though, I don't believe that any culture really outwardly condones domestic violence.
There's a ton of myths about the causes of abuse, like alcohol, legitimate grievances with the victim, or just the abuser being bad-tempered. How would you characterize the real causes of abuse?
Abuse is about power and control. Alcohol and drug use might increase the level of physical danger. Stress may trigger abusive incidents. But generally, abusive patterns of power and control are the core of domestic violence. And certainly there's always the myth that maybe she or he, depending on who the victim is, may have done something to cause it. But really, there is never any excuse for domestic violence or for violence at all. No one deserves it, no matter what their actions may have been. Another belief is that it's just an anger control problem, and that you just need to take some classes that will help you control your anger. But usually abusers are more often to use anger as an excuse for their behavior. You can think of the fact that we all get angry, but most of us don't become abusive when we're angry. Abusers are generally in total control of their actions, and anger management courses tend to turn out better batterers, teach them how to control their anger even more. The better batterers become at controlling their anger, the more control they have over abusive episodes and their partners. And you can also look at the fact that most abusers are really some of the most charming men that you would meet, or women, as the case may be. They really do have control over their anger, so it's not an anger control problem. It just simply comes down to the issues of maintaining power and control over the survivor.
An increasing number of anti-feminist activists try to deny that abuse is a gendered phenomenon, saying that women do it just as much, and some try to imply that women do it even more than men. What's your take on the controversy?
Well, I will certainly agree that men can be abused, whether their partners are male or female. But all the studies have shown, approximately 85% of victims of domestic violence are women, and 95% of batterers are men. So there definitely is some gender differences there. There's also differences in looking at when women do abuse, the reasons that they abuse. There's also tends to be differences. Usually the women that are arrested and sent to, violence intervention classes tend to be what we call secondary abusers. They are being abusive, and that's certainly something that needs to be dealt with. But generally, it's in retaliation to the abuse that they're experiencing to begin with, and that's how they've learned to deal with it. That's their survival mechanism. So there's definitely a gendered component to domestic violence.
Another big issue is the misconceptions out there about why women or men in the minority of cases stay with their abusers. Can you talk some about why women might have real reasons, or victims really, would have real reasons to stay with their abusers, even though, obviously nobody enjoys being abused?
Well, there are many factors that make leaving an abusive relationship extremely different. Extremely difficult. Abusers often isolate their victims, which means victims of abuse rely on their abusers for love and for financial resources. The abusers have turned their friends and family away from the survivor, and they've turned the survivor away from their friends and family. They truly believe that those people aren't willing to support them. Many victims of abuse also fear leaving because they think their abusers will carry out threats made in the relationship. And they fear this for good reasons, because the vast majority of serious injury and homicide by intimates occur when the victim is leaving, and the abuser has nothing more to lose. And in fact, some studies indicate that about 75% to 85% of intimate homicides happen after and because the survivor has left the relationship. In addition, not enough resources exist to help victims of abuse leave their relationships. So they leave, but they have nowhere to go. Shelters are often full. There's not enough financial resources to actually help them out. If they do receive any sort of welfare, there's job requirements, and usually it ends up putting them in a minimum wage job, and they're trying to support themselves and their children, and it's just not really possible. And many times they just feel that they end up sacrificing their safety in order to go back and have some sort of security, particularly financial. And there's also definitely there still may be feelings of love there, and so they may genuinely miss their abusers because they're remembering the good times and not necessarily the bad times. So that can happen too. There's definitely additional barriers for people who have, for instance, disabilities, or if they are in a gay or lesbian relationship, they may feel, rightly or wrongly, that there are fewer resources out there for them. So there's a number of barriers that women face when trying to leave an abusive relationship, and sometimes the myths about what causes abuse and why women would stay can also serve as a barrier, because they reach out to somebody, they reach out to the police, they reach out to the courts, and they're not being supported, and so they feel that they really have no choice but to go back.
And since you work with women that are living overseas, I imagine, do you find that a lot of your clients, the move overseas as part of the social isolation issue, that the move overseas is part of the abuser's mechanisms for getting them away from help?
Absolutely. Whether they're married to an American and moving overseas for work or travel, or whether the abuser is from the country that they're moving to, moving them overseas, they suddenly have far fewer resources. They don't have the friends. They don't have their family. And again, they may not have access to the resources that are there, or there may not be any resources. They are surrounded by their abuser's family and friends oftentimes, and so they're kind of, that can sometimes serve as an additional kind of protection of the abuser and barrier to the survivor. So that definitely can happen. Many times the abuse becomes significantly worse once they have gotten over there. Maybe the abuser feels safer in the other country. The isolation issue certainly can play into that. Other times there's abuse going on before, and the survivor truly believes, like, we can move over here and that's going to be a fresh start, only to find out that it's actually going to get worse once they move over there.
If you'd like to learn more about the American Domestic Violence Crisis Line, please visit 866-USWOMEN.org. Thanks for coming on to the program, Jen.
Thank you so much.
People have asked me complained in comments about my tendency to call our side pro-choice and our opposition anti-choice. And I agree that pro-choice is a weak phrase, that something like advocates for reproductive justice is more accurate, but it's a mouthful. In truth, no one really complained about that, though, because all the complaints were coming, for obvious reasons, from anti-choicers who want me to comply with their pro-life PR campaign. It's an amazing bit of entitlement. I don't see why I owe a damn thing to people who wish to take away my basic right to bodily autonomy. What I especially won't do for them is lie for them, and calling them pro-life is a blatant lie. The Guttmacher Institute just released another report showing exactly how pro-death anti-choice policies really are. The report showed that while abortion bans did absolutely nothing to reduce the abortion rate, they were extremely effective in getting women killed and maimed, to the tune of 70,000 deaths a year and 5 million injuries, many of which resulted in permanent damage. If you stand by a policy to kill 70,000 women a year, you are a lot of things, but pro-life isn't one of them. While the media continues to use the inaccurate term pro-life to describe people who are better described as anti-choice, I saw alarming evidence that other inaccurate frames from anti-choicers were creeping into the media. For instance, Alex Witt used a bit of right-wing framing on MSNBC Live recently.
They're considered threatening, rather, to consider backing a third party even if the GOP nominates a pro-abortion candidate like Rudy Giuliani.
Alex, to really sound like an anti-choice crank, you need to say pro-abort. No, for real. Check out any anti-choice website and you'll see the term pro-abort instead of pro-abortion. They think it sounds more insulting or something, but it just has the effect of making them sound like they're incapable of handling more than two syllables per word. The problem with the term pro-abortion is not the supposedly insulting part. For instance, I think it's a good term to describe someone who is currently pregnant and seeking a way not to be. But it's not a good term to describe people who support abortion rights. For instance, you can support abortion rights while personally not wishing to ever have an abortion, which is sort of Giuliani's position on this for obvious reasons. I've met plenty of pro-choice activists who themselves wouldn't feel right getting an abortion, but they respect freedom of religion and don't think that you should have to live by their religious rules. In fact, according to the Guttmacher report, if you're personally uncomfortable with abortion and wish to see less of them, the best stance to take is to be pro-choice. The rule of thumb is the more liberal the abortion laws in a country, the lower the abortion rate. That's because there's more to being pro and anti-choice than just views on abortion. Pro-choicers tend to advocate a whole package of contraception access and sex education, and anti-choicers tend to oppose the whole package. Pro-choice policies reduce the number one cause of abortion, unplanned pregnancy. So, strictly from a numbers sense, anti-choicers are the ones better described as pro-abortion. Which makes sense. Their views are more consistent with punishing women for having sex than anything else, and really, what's a better punishment for sex than getting an unsafe, dirty abortion just because you didn't have condoms in the first place?
Now listen up. Now gather around. Now listen up.
I don't have a mailbag this week, but that's okay because I want to take the extra time to express my dismay at the Today Show, who ran a segment on how women who take advantage of our hard-won right to delay marriage and childbirth are actually not humans, but mechanical devices called, I swear to God, fembots. And lest you think I'm exaggerating about what makes you a fembot, let me assure you I'm not.
Tell us what a fembot is. Describe that for us.
Well, a fembot is really someone who doesn't want to be held to the stereotype of women as nurturers and carers who sit around talking about their feelings all the time. She's someone who wants to get on with life. And women's changing roles in the workplace now, they have more responsibility, they're earning more, gives them more choices. So this woman, the fembot, is putting off getting married, she's putting off having children. She may have several relationships before she does eventually get married. And I think that changes the way she interacts with other people.
I'm having a little trouble believing that nearly every female friend of mine who has decided to live a little and delay marriage and babies until they're ready can be treated like a subhuman machine. I'd even go so far as to say that women like me who don't want kids are perfectly human too. I think that women can have a range of lifestyle choices and be just fine. But nope, according to the Today Show, we're all broken shells, barely women at all, just really pathetic and sad.
Personally, I think that's a little sad. I mean, that's just my take on this. Janet, one of the traits is being emotionally unavailable. Is that a healthy thing to be?
Well, clearly being emotionally unavailable is not healthy because we need to be connected. And when you're emotionally unavailable, not only do you have difficulty expressing your your own feelings, but identifying how other people are feeling as well. And so the implication as mothers and as nurturers, which I think it's not a stereotype, our brains are wired to be nurturers.
She does go on to admit that it's entirely possible for a woman to have a career and maybe even wait to have babies without being an emotional cripple. But the show immediately follows up with a checklist and more warnings that women who have careers or don't get married to the very first boy they kiss are in grave danger of becoming very close to sociopathic.
Yeah, and if you do happen to think maybe you are, or you know someone in your life who might be one of these extreme cases, we're calling them fembots, there are some signs to look for someone who seems to be emotionally unavailable. What are they as we talk about them?
Again, I think it starts with yourself. If you find that you can't react to a situation where you probably need to in terms of figuring out exactly what you're feeling, then that's a problem. Or if you're not curious about your own life and other people's lives, and also your ability and a capacity to love and give love.
I think that if our brains were wired for nurturing, we wouldn't be in danger of losing our capacity to love just because we know how to unwrap a condom or because we have desk jobs. Thanks to Andy at Women's Voices for the tip on this. The battle against reproductive rights isn't just being played out in the courts and on the streets. Stuff like this, where it's implied that women who exert control over our lives are not really women at all, is also a threat. The birth control pill, the ability to marry when we want, the right to choose, the right to earn a living, these are all things that improve women's lives, but shows like this pretend the opposite is true. This week's Wisdom of Wingnuts is about vaginas and how they seem to scare a good deal of the DC punditry, at least when they're underneath the skirts of candidates. This clip is of Tucker Carlson and right-wing pundit Cliff May hyperventilating over the possibility that people might enjoy electing a female president.
You should vote for her because she's a woman. They say that all the time. She just said that on The View. I mean, that's like their rationale.
Well, at least call her a vaginal American as opposed to...
Is that the new phrase?
I think that is, yeah.
Well, that's nasty. I don't think I can say that.
If she wins the nomination, I expect the misogynist hysteria to get uglier and uglier.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.